The numbers of total motor neurons in these segments, the lumbosacral-spinal cord, and these are the limb motor neurons only, not the most medial group, which is trunk neurons, and you'll see that there is very little evidence of any loss until about the age of 60, when a very distinct loss occurs, not severe in many people, and if we exclude these cases here, with the very lowest counts, the mean loss between 60 and 95, which was the oldest patient we examined, is around 21% of the total numbers. You'll see, however, that there is great variation in that number above 65, and you'll see that one case here has a number which is only half that found in youth and middle age, and that in a woman of 65, and I'm going to mention her and the other two cases in a little more detail in one moment.
What is the
ordinance? Oh, the limb motor neurons in thousands per total length of the lumbosacral spinal cord, that segments L1 to S2. I think the other thing that is surprising, if I can just show you two pictures, here's a cluster of typical anterior horn cells, large motor neurons, from a boy of 15, and here a picture from a man of 95, who had lost some motor neurons, and who clearly has large collections of lipofuscin. That's what mostly these pale areas are, and we've made a good many detailed observations on this, but I think in general you can see that the changes to this method of staining, and to a good many others, are not highly significant.
Excuse me, would you mind
questions
again?
Not a bit.
Do you find any evidence of hypertrophy of anterior horn cells during this period?
I have a later slide which I wasn't intended to show, showing that on measuring the size of anterior horn cells in normal individuals, there is a gradual increase in size from youth to old age. But one of the possibilities is that it is largely accounted for by accumulation of lipofuscin, but that would be a very difficult thing to establish. That increase in size could well be accounted for by an increase in lipofuscin content in the motor neurons. That would be very difficult, I think, to establish. But they do increase in size throughout life. Now, I just want to mention these three cases. A man of 92 years old had a total number of 22,000 limb motor neurons. That's roughly two-fifths of what you'd expect him to have from youth. Now, he'd lived on his own and cared for himself until 3 months before his death, and he'd been physically and mentally active until his final illness, during which he largely ceased to care for himself, and indeed he was eventually found dying in his flat, severely hypothermic, and he only survived for a further 3 days. The cause of his hypothermia was never actually established. It may have resulted from a fall because he had a good deal of soft tissue injury. His motor neurons were diffusely reduced in number and appeared somewhat small and irregular in shape, the only case in the series that did have an unusual looking motor neuron. There was no glial increase. There was no evidence of acutely degenerating neurons, and the samples of his leg muscles showed no suggestion of grouped fiber atrophy. There was a further man, aged 95, with a total count of 32,000, that's about half. He had been in employment until the age of 88, and had been vigorous and mentally active until 3 months before his death, when he developed a severe depressive illness, and afterwards was very reluctant to be mobilized or to take part in any activity. Again, apart from this diffuse loss of motor neurons, there was no obvious abnormality in his spinal cord, although there was an apparent increase in glial cells, which we afterwards, I think, satisfactorily accounted for by the contraction in his anterior horn cell size. One further case is worth mentioning. That's the woman of 65 who only had 25,000 motor neurones. She was killed in a road accident whilst out shopping. Her general practitioner had seen her on a number of occasions in the previous 5 years, and although he'd performed no neurological examination on her, he was not aware of any symptomatology or signs relating to her neuromuscular system. So these cases illustrate that in normal old age you can have a very severe reduction in limb motor neurones in old people who have retained considerable and possibly even normal mobility and physical activity, certainly for their age and throughout their whole lifespan. The investigation also shows what appears to be a stability under normal circumstances of limb motor neurones throughout the early part of life, but a mean loss in the 3 decades between 60 and 90 of about 20% of the numbers to be found in youth. Now, it's not possible to compare our findings with any others that we're aware of, because no one else has been stupid enough to do this. However, Kawamura and Dick, in 1977, reported a very detailed examination of 18 cases aged between 17 and 81 years in which they examined the motor neurone content of the third, fourth, and fifth lumbosacral segments in humans, as well as the myelinated fibers of the anterior roots. And this next slide is made up from their figures. And it shows only one significant difference from ours. That is that they felt that there was a loss of motor neurons throughout life, that there was not a stability such as we had thought was present in those first 7 decades. I don't know what the discrepancy is or how it arises between our findings and theirs, except, of course, they have got very few cases in this period between 20 and 50 years. And that may have revealed something somewhat different from their present figures. However, the total loss from youth to old age is strikingly similar to ours. They counted up to the age of 82 years, and in that period, some 18.8% of motor neurons were lost. That compared pretty well with their findings in the anterior roots and the loss of large and medium-sized myelinated fibers, and it also compares extremely well with our own total loss of motor neurons throughout life. Their figures between the age of 17 and 60 years of age would account for a loss of about 12.5% of the total motor neuron count. Now, judging from our own figures and from theirs, which were all taken from normal subjects dying rapidly without any long or debilitating illness, one could only say that the normal subject may lose a very considerable proportion of his motor neurons from the lumbosacral cord without that apparently having a significant effect in relation to his muscle function. Except as that, of course, as in all of us, decreases in old age. It does strike me from these figures, therefore, that if cell loss is continuous throughout life, as Kawamura suggests, there is only some 6% of the normal motor neurons lost over a period of 30 years. And that seems little enough to cause any deterioration, at least in normal people. But of course, this statement only has any credibility if one is certain that the neurons that remain in the spinal cord after an attack of poliomyelitis are normal and able to withstand whatever mechanisms are responsible for the steady loss of neurons in later life. And we have heard this morning the privilege of knowing that, in fact, almost all the motor neurons in any attack of poliomyelitis are infected by the virus at some stage. Now, I want very briefly to review three different investigations that looked at the effect of immobilization on spinal cord anterior horn cell counts. I should say that only the third group we were specifically looking at the spinal cord with the purpose of seeing what was the effect of profound immobilization. The others two were done for different purposes. Nevertheless, they illustrate something rather curious. The first group I want to show is five cases of Duchenne dystrophy dying between the ages of 15 and 21 years and having had between 8 and 12 years of total immobility as a result of their muscular disease. You will see that they have totally normal neuron counts. Indeed, their mean is higher than the mean for those cases with the same age group, though not significantly so. This seems to me not only remarkable, in fact, in relation to their total immobility, but particularly remarkable when you think that in the last several years of their lives, patients with muscular dystrophy literally have no lower limb muscles. Their muscles are replaced by fat and a very small amount of fibrous tissue. So here we have apparent preservation of motor neurons in the absence of any total and any performance of their normal function. And again, the motor neurons from a control child, 15 years, and motor neurons from a case of the same age dying after 8 years of total immobilization from Duchenne dystrophy. In fact, the neuron size in cases of Duchenne dystrophy is again somewhat higher than that of normal controls. Of course, the weakness of saying that there is no loss of cells in this prolonged immobilization from Duchenne dystrophy lies in the fact that we do not know the total numbers of motor neurons in Duchenne dystrophy in the early weeks of life. I don't know of anyone who has done such a count. But recently, Sushila has reported that in chickens with muscular dystrophy, the neuron counts in the early weeks of life are considerably in excess of normal. So perhaps the situation is actually repeated in humans with Duchenne dystrophy. To get at a higher age group, we looked at five cases of dystrophia myotonica. And once more, you'll see that with one minor exception, all the cases of dystrophia myotonica had motor neuron counts that fall within the lower group of their normal counterparts. These cases had had symptoms from 8 to 20 years of age, and all had had moderate or severe disability for many years before their deaths. Now, in two of these cases, there were abnormal neurons present. They appeared to be small, and there is an increase of glial content in the spinal cord in these cases. But in three, we could detect no significant abnormality. There's the motor neurons from a normal case, age 47, and there are the motor neurons from a dystrophia myotonica, age 50. We then looked at a group of cases of paraplegia following injury to the thoracic and spinal and lower cervical cord, which caused total paraplegia for periods varying from 4 months to 13 years. And here you see the results of that, and again, with one exception, that's the man paralyzed for 13 years, all the remainder lie within the normal limits. Within this group, there were two cases in which there were quite remarkably severe chromatolytic lesions in numerous neurons in the spinal cord. The significance of this, we don't know, and this group clearly requires a good deal more investigation before any suggestions can be made about that. Nevertheless, as you can see, they do not, in fact, have any significant or profound loss of motor neurons under these circumstances. Now, one other observation is perhaps worth mentioning, and that is, what evidence do we have that damaged neurons at one stage in life are more susceptible to loss at a later stage? And in relation to human spinal cord motor neurons, I think that's a very difficult question to ask. So we have looked at cases of amputation with survival over varying periods from 3 months to 50 years. Of course, it is traditional, and I think traditionally correct, that experimentally, severe chromatolysis of affected neurons occurs when you perform axotomy, and that the closer the axon severance is to the perikaryon of the neuron, the greater will be the chromatolysis of the cell and the more likely it is to die. Strangely, however, in human observations, and they've gone on certainly for 100 years, there has been a continuing disagreement as to what happens to spinal cord motor neurons in human amputation over prolonged periods of time. However, Kawamura and Dick in 1981 did report, by their very detailed method, which I think can't be faltered, of counting neurons, that there was a considerable loss in motor neurons in two cases with amputation 4.5 and 9 years previously. Our observations are on five cases in which after 3 months, this was the soonest one, you can see what was illustrated this morning, numerous neurons have undergone very severe chromatolysis. And here you see, in addition to the loss of basophilic nissl substance, I think you can just see the neuron pushed to the margin and the cell is swollen and has lost its sharply angulated contours, and that's entirely characteristic of this condition. And you see there another peripherally situated nucleus bulging out the cell. Now that case at 3 months had lost no motor neurons, but it did have extensive chromatolysis. But here is the case that died 50 years after amputation. And there in the middle is a typical severely chromatolytic neuron with the nucleus moved over to one side. And I think here is an indubitable example of a damaged neuron which survives in a damaged state for an extremely long period. But in the cases that we examined with survival over 18 months, that was four of them, all of them lost neurons from the appropriate segments of the spinal cord. The top graph here shows you a control case and shows you how by this method the actual numbers in the different segments closely parallels each other. And here, with the right limb amputation, you see the approximately same number as far as the L4 segment, and then a dip and a considerable loss in the numbers of cells after that in the segments below. So here is an example, clearly not the same as viral infection of anterior horn cells, but an example of damage, severe damage in this case, which I guess sectioning of an axon is, which results in the appearance within the spinal cord of abnormal neurons over more than half a lifespan, and with gradual but continual loss of some of them. And perhaps this is as close as an illustration as to what might be happening in late poliomyelitis as we can bring forward at this stage. So, in summary, Observations on the normal aging motor neuron suggest that cell loss through aging is unlikely to be the cause of serious late deterioration unless the neurons which remain in many cases of poliomyelitis have already suffered severe damage. One would think that they had and are therefore more susceptible to whatever causes the gradual fall off of neurons in later life. Investigations also suggest that immobilization in itself is unlikely to be an explanation for this loss of neurons. But the slow death of motor neurons for many years after an abnormality has been produced in them, such as in this case by limb amputation, may be a parallel to what is happening in poliomyelitis. Now I wonder how we test whether this is the fact in poliomyelitis. One method, of course, would be from now on to collect the spinal cords from those cases of poliomyelitis dying, old cases dying now, who have been previously extremely carefully examined and on whom we know whether or not there has been delayed deterioration, so that we can compare the two groups. I still think that might leave one in very considerable difficulty. So I think what we really need is cases, and those will mostly be in pathology blocks at this time, and I have managed to gather a few in the last several weeks, in which mostly unilateral paralysis has been present after poliomyelitis, and we are now going to try to gather cases that have survived for periods between 5 and 25 years, so that we can examine the appearance, the size, the nucleolar size, the shape of the neurons, on the damaged side and on the abnormal side. Two have been sent to me from a friend recently, and it's far too soon to be able to say anything about them, but these are the appearance of the neurons in this case from the side that was least affected by the poliomyelitis, from the left leg, from the left side of the spinal cord. On the other side, those are the neurons partly embedded in much more densely gliosed tissue, much higher glial cell counts, and I think that looks hopeful in terms of statistical differences in size and in nuclear and nucleolar size and neuronal shape. One other possibility I think does occur and is worth a second thought, and that is this. In a severe attack of poliomyelitis, with recovery, or rather without death, the damaged areas of neurons are replaced by intense gliosis. Here you see an example not within intense gliosis, but within an area of very increased glial fibers. Now, under many circumstances, the remaining neurons will have to send their axons to the anterior roots through those intensely gliosed parts of the spinal cord. Is it just possible that another mechanism, therefore, is the very slow pressure and distortion of the myelinated axons of the remaining neurons in the spinal cord as they traverse the gliosed tissue to reach the anterior horns? Both these possibilities we intend to explore in the next year.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tomlinson. Don't go away. This is obviously a very unique body of work and very much related to the theme of this meeting. I wonder if I could exercise my function as moderator by initiating the discussion by very quickly showing two slides. We have been estimating the numbers of functioning motor units in a number of human muscles over several years. I'm sorry, the spot is top right. Top right. This time. There we are. We have a very simple method for estimating the number of functioning motor units, obviously, during life. And over the years, we've now studied, I suppose, about 500 muscles. And in the bottom part of the figure, you see the numbers of functioning motor units which have been normalized together with one standard deviation as a function of age. It's age in years along the abscissa. And very much in keeping with Dr. Tomlinson's results, you can see that there is no significant drop-off of motor units until the beginning of the seventh decade. And after that, there is a progressive fall. Now, the decline that you see there is very much greater than that which Dr. Tomlinson showed, and I think there are two reasons for it. First of all, most of the muscles examined in our study have been distal muscles, intrinsic muscles of the foot and hand. And we now know that these muscles are more susceptible to aging effects than more proximal muscles. The second reason for the discrepancy is that we are looking at function, whereas Dr. Tomlinson is looking at structure. And I think it is quite possible that one may have motor neurons and motor axons which may not be exerting any excitatory effect on the muscle. And there are two examples of this. One is myotonic dystrophy, where Dr. Tomlinson showed that there are normal numbers of motor neurons in the spinal cord. And yet there are three independent studies now showing a loss of functioning motor units in the same condition. The second example is axotomy, where it has been shown by Dick Stein at the University of Alberta in Edmonton that you may have many axons in which the axis cylinder has shrunk within the myelin sheath, and these axons are not excitable. Yet the fact that the axis cylinders are still present means that the motor neurons must also still be present, and yet clearly they could not be excitable. Now, the second slide, the last slide, addresses the problem. Again, it's spot top right when it comes. The second slide addresses the problem as to whether these losses of functioning motor units have functional significance. Does one actually become weaker as one gets older? Well, common observation would suggest that one does, but in fact the literature is very confusing on this subject. What is shown here are observations on the maximum voluntary torque generated by dorsiflexor and plantar flexor muscles of more than 100 subjects who are healthy and in good condition for their age. The elder subjects were two men aged 100. And again, you can see that there's a two-component analysis, that there's really no change up until the late 50s, and then after 50, there is again a progressive loss, this time of strength, before it was of functioning motor units. Right, I'd now like to open the discussion to the floor.
For those of you, or Johnson, Columbus, Ohio, for those of you who are polio patients in the audience, polio persons, I'd like to offer a happy note. That is, Dr. Kotke has shown some 10 years ago that a grade of F, or 3 out of 5 on the Medical Research Council grade, requires only 10% of your motor units. So therefore, for someone to actually lose function, it would take a great deal more than just getting old, unless you're already pretty much there.
I was wondering whether or not you would offer me the money now to send my body to you for your post-mortem study, so I gain some of the benefit of the financial remuneration post death. On a different note, I was wondering whether or not you performed any axonal diameter or axonal area measurements at all to determine whether there was hypertrophy with a loss of motor units.
No, we haven't done that. If I could comment on the first part of your question first, I wouldn't pay you anything because I should be dead first.
You mean it's up to my folks to send my body to you at their cost, I see.
But on the second, we haven't done that, and I think we wouldn't try and do that by that particular method. What we are doing, and we've not just acquired the automated apparatus with which to do it without undue stress, we would be measuring from now on both nuclear and nucleolar size, since there's a great deal of evidence that nucleolar size in particular relates to quantitative protein manufacture within a cell, and that is what one assumes is required in terms of the axon and its continuation. So that's what we would be looking at in the near future.
One of the things that interests us in our own work is that we found that with partial denervation, the axons do hypertrophy. Of course, this has been shown by Gutman in about 1953. The second question I have is, do you find a great reduction in the number of dendritic processes with aging in the spinal cord as been shown in the cortex?
We have only indirect evidence about that, but we think it's good indirect evidence. Effectively staining the dendritic trees of anterior horn cells is, I think, about as difficult a job in histology as you can find, and it requires, in our experience, getting post-mortem material within 2 or 3 hours of death, and that's not a thing that we find very easy.
I spoke to Lloyd Guth about that, and he was wondering whether or not that might be one of the reasons why there is a loss of function with aging.
Right.
The decreased input into the anterior horn cell would greatly reduce the individual's capacity to respond to stress.
Well, there is, we have some indirect evidence that that might well be so, because the anterior horn cells in the human, from the age of about 20, the anterior horns themselves gradually reduce in volume. And they reduce in volume even though the reduction in motor neurons, which are much the largest motor neurons, of course, in the anterior horns, remain stable or are only minimally reduced. And if we take as an example the cerebral cortex, where something rather similar happens in old age, I think the conclusion that people are reaching now is that that contraction in size is largely a contraction of the dendritic bed. And that evidence is certainly present in relation to a reduction in size of anterior horns with age.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Herbison.
I think your results, Dr. Thomason, are extremely provocative. Since we're speculating, I wonder whether we can't speculate a bit about three things we have heard nothing about. One would be sustaining collaterals. Another would be the innervation ratio. And the third I've sort of forgotten, but let's take the two I did mention. The Duchenne atrophy is a most remarkable state of affairs, where the axons without an obvious termination are still sustaining themselves. But it is said that they do have collaterals within the gray matter. Before they leave the gray matter, they have axon collaterals, which conceivably could sustain the cell, so that the cell is not deprived of a normal termination. Perhaps you'd like to comment on that before we take it up.
Well, I think the situation in Duchenne dystrophy is totally extraordinary for a number of reasons. Firstly, the axons themselves have been deprived of their standard function. Secondly, this much postulated muscle to motor neuron trophic influence certainly can't exist in the end stages of muscular dystrophy. Thirdly, I think it does demonstrate, unless what you're asking is a fact, that collaterals are the main source of support to the cell, it demonstrates, I think, how much one can be fooled by the morphological appearance of neurons in relation to function, because I think it would be extremely difficult on standard morphological grounds to diagnose the spinal cord of a case of muscular dystrophy from that of a normal control of the same age. So something exists which clearly keeps it, at least if not functioning normally, keeps it from atrophying and dying. And that, I think, has to be both dendritic and axonal distribution within the anterior horns. But we have no evidence. Again, it's something that we would like to do, but I think we'll find it extremely difficult to do. We have no quantitative evidence or qualitative evidence of either an increase or a normal content of collaterals within the anterior horn from these neurons. I know of no one who has that information.
Well, it's very difficult to study that.
Yes.
Because it's close quarters, for one thing. And with light microscopy, almost hopeless to do anything.
Yes.
Now, the other question I have is the matter of innervation ratio. Although we don't have very much information about innervation ratios, there is enough to indicate that the proximal muscles of an extremity have a much lower innervation ratio than the distal digit, for example. Is it possible that there may be different responses depending on whether the neuron has a high innervation ratio or a low one?
I'm sorry, I don't think I can give an answer to that. I don't know whether Alan can help.
Not on that.
I'm sure what you're saying is correct, but I don't have any evidence that relates to it, I'm afraid.
That was Dr. Brodian.
Stolov from Seattle. I want to make sure I understand what, to me, seems like a contradiction. We know electrophysiologically that motor unit duration and motor unit size increases with age. The size principle, as I understand it, tells us that large anterior horn cells have large diameter motor neurons and more muscle fibers per neuron. I believe, though, you kept telling us during your talk, at least from what you saw, that with age there is no mean or increase in anterior horn cell diameter, or at least there are no large ones seen more often in the older age group than in the younger. Can you help me with that?
I did say, I hope you got it right, I did say that with increasing age, the motor neuron size does increase.
Does increase?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were saying it actually shrunk.
No, okay. It increases with age.
I had a Maynard. I wanted to ask about the amputees. You said that there was a chromatolysis that was still present in these this patient that was 50 years after his amputation. Do you know from other disease processes whether, does that mean that he may have just been now having some cells die, or does that mean that it could have been in that condition for 50 years?
Well, I'm making assumptions over a long age gap.
Yeah.
But within 3 months of amputation in the mid-thigh, the great majority of neurons from L5 downwards in the lateral groups are chromatolytic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
As you go, and we've only done it in four stages between 3 months and 50 years, mm. but as you get into the many years past the amputation, you have a decreasing cell population.
Uh-huh.
And a decreasing number of remaining cells that are chromatolytic, but you still have those chromatolytic cells, and very occasionally you see a cell that is ballooned and vacuolated and is apparently at the stage of dying. I mean, it's an interpretation mm-hmm. sure. of a dynamic situation from a static piece of section, but it's at least conventional. It's what pathologists do.
Sure, but that's why you were hypothesizing that it had survived
that's
in that
right.
state for so
that's
long.
That's right.
Right. Then the second question related to that. I know it's early, but did you see any of those type of cells in those two polio patients that you looked at?
No, we did not. But I think that's early days. We have considerable difficulty. I think the material that we've used for counting and measuring goes through a very prolonged and careful hand processing system, because otherwise you get quite unacceptable variations in cell size through fixation abnormalities. The only polio cases we have on our files are people who died in the acute disease 30 odd years ago, and in going out to people for examples that we want, we're going to have to take them from cases in which the spinal cord has been treated sometimes reverently and sometimes not, as you know. And of course, if we have to judge material that has been rather crudely treated over this exercise, I think we're in pretty severe trouble.
Taylor from Sacramento. Dr. Tomlinson, continuing with the amputee, from what you have seen with the anterior horn cells, would you hypothesize that a similar reduction in dorsal horn cells would occur also, or do you think there's that much difference between the afferent and efferent neurons?
I think there is a lot of difference, and I don't think you would see the same numbers of reduction.
This question about the possible difference between the afferent and efferent systems, I'd like to come back to it because I want to know whether you know that there is no difference, or there is if you know that there is a difference or there is no difference, because I know that in a completely different area of aging brain, when I studied the conceptual intelligence index, it was exactly the same curve. The intelligence decreases, conceptual intelligence decreases from 30 years to 60, according to one slope, and then suddenly slope changes at 60. So I wonder whether this is a general law of aging as far as the central nervous system is concerned.
It isn't a general law, I think that's for certain, but how far you can spread it, I don't know. But for instance, if you take cerebral atrophy, there is some, it's not our work here, there is some very beautiful work showing that the loss of cerebral volume is minute until about the age of 60. And then on average, it really does tumble down at rather an alarming rate. If you take cerebellar Purkinje cells, there's very good evidence that they are stable in number until about the age of 60, when they begin to fall off. But there are other cell populations that appear to be stable throughout life. The inferior olive, for instance, is said not to lose any cells at all. On the other hand, the cells of the locus ceruleus fall off from the 30s until old age is a continuous stream. So I think this concept that there is a model that you can apply to any area within the central nervous system isn't correct. There are stable populations of neurons. The mammary bodies, for instance, are said to be totally stable in number throughout youth to old age. And I think the unfortunate part about it is that somebody, not me, but some other people have really got to count the cells throughout life in every different nucleus that exists. And then we can have a library, you know, with a list showing exactly what happened.
This session is now concluded.